Hello, everybody. We are back.
You said that weird.
Me?
Ooh, that smells good.
Oh, really? Mm. I forgot we were kind of doing the... Is it called the Bad Baptist?
We're back.
What the fuck was that, dude?
And we brought a friend with us. A friend that's been with us for a couple episodes.
Oh, yeah.
The Big Bad Baptist.
And he's back.
He looks a little upset.
He's angry.
It smells good. So this one is the blueberry pie.
Yeah, he's a good shepherd, but his flock is scared.
Dude, it smells so good. It smells like a blueberry pie. I think it's going to be great.
I'm ready.
12.3%. So it's going to hit here.
Good.
Give me your glass. I'll pour you some, kind sir. No, you don't.
Give me the whole thing. I like it. Looks good.
Smell it.
I forgot we were doing this. I'll have to get some more. I like
that. I don't remember which ones we've had. I know we've had the breakfast one. I think that there was like a... There's like a breakfast one and then like a maple pancake one I think we've had.
It does smell like a blueberry pie.
It does really smell good. We're just going to sniff it all episode. Wow. That's kind of... I don't know. I think it's really good.
It would taste good with like a muffin.
It would. Yeah, blueberry muffin.
I had to think about that.
It would be good in the morning in a mug.
So... I was watching a thing on the YouTube. It was a breakdown of Skinnamarink. Skinnamarink.
Mm. We were talking about it before we hit record. Cool. I've heard of the movie Skinnamarink. I've never watched it, and Cleet said that it's a mind fuck.
Yeah, it is to a degree. I went in watching it with no pretext, and I don't know. I was at first disappointed, but the more I thought about it, that was an interesting show.
So it's one of those ones that days later it hits you and you're like, you know what? Yeah. Actually.
It's like not a slow burn, but it's like you got to metabolize it to break it down to its bits to try to figure out what the fuck you just watched.
But, those movies are good.
Yeah, I watched a thing on YouTube that was breaking down their theory about what it was all about. And it was pretty good. I might consider watching it again. Maybe
the wife and I will watch it tonight. Did you see Mother? The movie Mother? It had... Jennifer Lawrence in it.
I've seen clips of it.
It's like that, except it's way more in your face. Like, by the time the credits roll, you're like, what did I watch? It is horrible. Yeah, but it's like, it hits you in the face, and at the end, you feel almost like violated watching it. It's one of those where you're like, oh my God, I don't know if I can ever get that time back.
Isn't that thing like... Isn't it someone in the woods that like is the mother for like some kids?
No.
Okay, then maybe I didn't watch the show.
No, this is it's
because your description of it doesn't match my recollection.
Well, because there's a movie called Mama, which I think you're thinking.
Yeah,
of.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, they're very close in title. Obviously, Mama, Mother, Mommy. You watch Mommy?
The goddamn matriarchy.
No, but this one it's kind of like Mother Nature. Essentially, it's fucking weird, right, man. If you have the chance to watch it, I'm not going to even say it's good. I'm not going to say it's bad. It's an experience. That's what I'll leave it with.
Okay.
So maybe watch Skinnamarink. But welcome back. Thanks for being here. We are 12 subs away from the Clown Motel. And we find ourselves in a bit of a predicament because, the camera is taking a lot longer to get here. We're going to have to get this thing going quick.
We got like 8 subs in like a day. Yeah. I thought we had a little bit more time, but
we're not complaining.
We'll figure it out.
It's not a complaint. Yeah. It's kind of just we didn't expect it to kick off that quick.
Thank you guys. What a warm surprise.
Yeah, that was a good day.
A moist, warm surprise.
God. I don't know how to feel about what you just said. A moist, warm surprise.
A very welcoming.
The word moist.
Moist. Yeah,
half the people listening just cringed.
Warm regards.
Nice, moist, liquid surprise. Oh, God. Anyway, welcome to The Abyss, everybody. So happy to have you. We are continuing on our journey of the most notorious serial killers in the United States, part 8. So we only have 2 left after this, and then we are done. And then we... need to figure out what next iceberg or
there's some good
series
icebergs.
We're doing.
Someone I think recommended an iceberg.
We'll I think they did.
Look for it.
We've had like a horror movie iceberg.
Yeah.
We've had.
The horror movie iceberg can get good because it's like once you get really down there, I guarantee you there's snuff.
That's not good. That's not good. I'm not watching snuff. I'm not going
to
do it.
You don't have to watch it. You get a synopsis.
I don't know if I want to Google a snuff film, Cleet. I don't know. That one might...
FBI.
Yeah. You Googled some pretentious shit.
Tell me something new. I call that a Tuesday.
The FBI here constantly. Have you seen the West Valley Whacker this morning?
Warm regards. That was the note they left.
We're here for your nice, moist regard.
All right, what states are we doing?
I guess that's probably a good thing to do. Holy fuck. Okay. So the states on tap today, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island.
Let's do it.
So, yeah, we're getting close to the end, and Cleet is going to kick us off with Ohio.
All right. So, Ohio.
Ohio.
We're going to be talking about the Cleveland Torso Murderer.
Hmm?
That's a good name. The Torso Murderer.
Killed a bunch of torsos, huh?
Get your torso. I'm going to get it.
I am in blueberry heaven.
During the 1920s, Cleveland was a city on the rise. The population was booming with new immigrants from around the globe, joining the workforce that served the backbone of the city's industrial and manufacturing economy. The city's wealthy lived in the grand homes along Millionaire's Row and supported many new educational and cultural institutions. However, Cleveland was hit hard by the Great Depression of 1929. During the 1930s, city leaders worked to help its struggling citizens and raise the community's morale.
Would they have a bunch of pizza parties?
Sorry, you're broke.
Here's a pizza on us.
The Great Lakes Exposition and the Republican National Convention were scheduled for 1936. Against the backdrop of a large city improving economically, one of the most prolific and gruesome serial killers of all time carried out his acts of horror, distracting the citizens of our city from the pride and prosperity of the times.
Or maybe he was just trying to take their mind off the fact that it was a Great Depression.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe he was depressed.
I'm not condoning his acts of violence, but maybe he's in his own sick way, like, I'm here to help.
Kind of seems like you're a mathematist.
Excuse me?
It's a cult, man.
A mathematician?
No, it's a cult. They believe that you need to get rid of all suffering in the world. 13 people were brutally murdered over the course of 4 years, beginning in 1934. All of them decapitated, most of them, while they were still alive.
Oh, it's going to be one of those stories.
Then the murders ended up abruptly as they began. Although safety director Elliot Ness claimed to have solved the crimes, no suspect was officially identified and no one was brought to trial. To this day, the Kingsbury Run murders remain one of the most sensational and intriguing unsolved crimes of our nation's history.
So we don't even know who did it.
Yeah, could have been you, man. Could have been you.
That'd be weird. I'd be really old.
Yeah.
Vampire. I'm a vampire who drinks blueberry beer.
Kingsbury Run is a prehistoric riverbed running from the flats, the area along Cuyahoga River near Lake Erie, to about 90th Street. Train and rapid transit tracks still run through the run. Bordered on the north by Woodland Avenue and on the south by Broadway Avenue, Kingsbury Run was a dark, dreary, and dangerous place in the 1930s. The dispossessed of the Great Depression lived in appalling conditions. Trash and filth dominating the makeshift hobo jungle.
Did you say hobo jungle?
Yeah. That's, yeah, hobo jungle.
Welcome to the jungle!
Ah, they make good liquor there, I'll tell you that much. That occupied much of the run. These people, most of them transients, often rode the rails to escape the brutal Cleveland winters or simply to keep moving. The area just to the east of the run was known as the Roaring Third Police Precinct, home to bars, brothels, flop houses, and gambling dens.
That sounds like your neck of the woods.
Oh, yeah.
Bars, brothels, and gambling dens.
Yeah, I call that a good weekend. I'm kidding. In this grim setting, the most notorious murder case in Cleveland's history would unfold. September 1934, a young man found the remains of a woman in her mid-30s, the torso with thighs still attached, but amputated at the knees, and washed up on the shores of Lake Erie, just east of Brottonow. Cuyahoga County Coroner A.J. Pierce noted that a chemical preservative on the skin, which had turned it red, tough and leathery.
Yikes.
The subsequent search yielded just as few other body parts, but her head was never found. The woman was never identified, as soon referred to as the Lady in the Lake. It wasn't until 2 years later that this find was included in the official killing total and thus became known as Victim Zero. It would be another year before the case began officially, and then it would be in another part of the city, the now infamous Kingsbury Run.
It's quite the fishing trip, man. You're just fishing and this torso washes up. You never fish again.
Imagine if you caught like 3 fish prior and you're like, am I going to eat the fish or not?
I know, I wouldn't. His leathery torso rolls up. Are you kidding me?
September 1935. 2 teenage boys discovered the decapitated, emasculated corpse of a white male at the base of Jackass Hill.
Jackass Hill?
Yeah, it's where you live, man.
I didn't think that was a thing.
Like, who named that hill?
Some jackass.
Like, they just hated who lived up there, like the mayor did. And he's like, you know, that guy's a jackass. Oh, I got an idea.
We'll forever name it Jackass Hill.
Anyways, where East 49th Street dead ends into Kingsbury Run. The body, naked, save for a pair of socks, was clean and drained of blood with rope burns around both wrists.
When we get to 1,000 subs, we're going to Jackass Hill.
Yeah.
100%.
We're going to go sledding down it. There's no snow on it, you jackass.
Not yet, but there will be.
God, just Ohio gets jackasses. Snow. Like, it feels like home. It feels like home. Yeah. Coroner Pierce determined the cause of death had been decapitation. Real home run there.
Really? Pierce. You don't say, Mr. Pierce.
Fingerprints identified this victim as Edward Andrazi, a 28-year-old white male who frequented the Roaring Third. While searching the crime scene, police discovered a second body nearby, also decapitated and emasculated. It appeared to have been covered with some chemical preservative as the Lady of the Lake.
The fuck is this guy doing?
This body apparently had been dead for at least a couple weeks. The 40-year-old white male was never identified.
It's not a neighborhood I want to live in where torsos just start showing up, especially on Jackass Hill.
Yeah, I bet you'd wake up, you're like, should I go to the brothel, but I might get murdered. I don't know.
The bar's a little bit closer. I'll go but to the gambling bar. Vicinity is but a couple more. But
gambling den.
But it's Brothel Wednesday.
And then you just get hammered, start walking the streets like.
And then you're a torso.
Yep.
On Jackass Hill.
Then you lose
Hill.
Your head, man.
Don't lose your head.
Don't lose your head. January 1936, a woman discovered parts of a woman's body neatly wrapped in newspaper and packed in 2 half-bushel baskets.
Good God.
The baskets were left alongside the Hart Manufacturing Building on Central Avenue near East 20th Street. The rest of the remains, except the head, were recovered about 10 days later in a nearby vacant lot on Orange Avenue. As with victim number 1 and victim number 2, the cause of death had been decapitation.
I think it's safe to say that all the causes of death in this story are decapitation.
In this case, however, the killer waited for rigor mortis to set in.
After death.
Disarticulating the rest of the body. Cleveland police used fingerprints to identify victim 3 as Florence Palillo, a waitress and barmaid who at the time of her death resided at East 32nd Street in Carnegie. Right on the edge of the Roaring Third.
So she's a waitress and a barmaid. So she works at the gambling vicinity and the bar.
Or she's, yeah. June 1936. Early one morning in Kingsbury Run, 2 young boys discovered the head of a white male wrapped in a pair of trousers close to the East 55th Street Bridge.
Wrapped his head in pants?
That's a bad way to go, man. The next day, Cleveland police found the body of the 20-some-year-old man the next day dumped in front of the Nickel Plate Railroad police building. Clean and drained of blood, the corpse was intact except for a severed head. Pierce again determined the death had been caused by decapitation. In spite of a fresh set of fingerprints and the presence of 6 distinctive tattoos on various parts of the body, police were never able to identify the victim. A plaster reproduction of the man's head, along with a diagram of the kind and location of the tattoos, were displayed at the Great Lakes Exposition of 1936. More than 100,000 people saw the death mask and tattoo chart, but the tattooed man was never identified. The original death mask, along with three others from the case, are on display at the Cleveland Police Museum. July 1936, a teenage girl came across the decapitated remains of a 40-year-old white male while walking through the woods near Clinton Road and Big Creek on the near west side of Cleveland.
I'm sorry, but that ruins your entire life. A teenage girl finds a fucking decapitated body?
So, you know, we don't have a lot of money and it's free to go walk and explore and... oh my God, a head! She'll never get ahead in life.
Wait, so she, she found the head.
Yeah.
Not the torso.
You're right.
Okay, you're right. That's, yeah, you you don't come back from that. I'm sorry. Ever.
Yeah, I don't know where she's headed.
You're so stupid. She found a bunch of kids kicking what they thought was a ball around. It was just a head. The kids were all blind. They didn't know what they were doing. Take that out, please. It's fucking monstrous.
What the head? The victim had been dead about 2 months, and his head, as well as a pile of bloody clothing, was found nearby. Judging by the enormous quantity of blood that had been seeped into the ground, this man had apparently been killed where his body was found. Victim number 5 was never identified.
So what I'm learning from this entire thing is just don't go to fucking Ohio.
Yeah, that's good. It's
probably I'm not going to go to Ohio. Honestly. I really want to see Jackass Hill, but not this bad.
Yeah.
Not this bad.
September 1936, a man tripped over the upper half of a man's torso while trying to hop a train at East 37th Street in Kingsbury Run.
Nope.
Cleveland police searched a nearby pool, which was nothing more than a big open sewer, and found the lower half of the torso and parts of both legs. Police sent a diver in to make the recovery. The numbers of onlookers that turned out to watch the grim spectacle was estimated at over 600, and the killer may well have been among them.
Yeah. Because they like to return to their fucking dirty work.
Oh, yeah.
Scene of the crime.
Victim number 6 was in his late 20s, and the cause of death, yet again, was decapitation. Coroner Pierce noted that the lack of hesitation marks in the disarticulation of the body indicated a strong, confident killer, very familiar with human anatomy. The victim died instantly when the head was cut off in one bold, clean stroke. Victim 6 was never identified.
So in this year, Coroner Pierce was like, he had the easiest job in the world. I mean to say that all the cause is decapitation.
Another decapitation. Why are people's heads falling off?
It's like, man, you have the most successful rate of actually calculating the death.
Yeah, it's true.
Mr. Pierce.
He's got an easy gig right now. Just find a bunch of heads. Yeah. Bodies. Torsos. Anyways. Fall 1936.
He can definitely make heads or tails of all the situations.
He can make heads or tails of this. Fall
so bad.
1936, media frenzy. 6 brutal killings in 1 year, and the police had neither clues nor suspects. The Cleveland Press, the Cleveland News, and the Cleveland Plain Dealer all reported almost daily on the killings and the lack of a suspect. Tension was high. Who was the mad butcher of Kingsbury Run? Giving in to the mounting pressure from the mayor, Harold Burton, recently appointed safety director Elliot Ness got more involved in the case.
Just imagine Pierce laying down for bed and his phone rings. Fucking again?
We found a head.
Another head?
I don't answer like the phone.
Heads or tails,
headed.
Sir? Heads, obviously.
Coroner Pierce called for what the newspaper dubbed a torso clinic, a meeting of police. The coroner and other experts to discuss information and to profile someone who could be responsible for these gruesome killings. The police department put Detective Peter Marilow and Martin Zalewski on the case full-time. They moved deftly through the seedy underworld that constituted the Run and the Roaring Third, often dressed the part while off-duty.
Yeah, I'm sure they visited a lot of those brothels on their way.
It's just part of the case.
You know what, Mr. Marilow? You've been at a lot of the brothels. I'm doing underground work.
It hurts to pee.
I might have contracted chlamydia. All for the job. We will find this person.
By the time the case had run its course, the two had interviewed more than 1,500 people. The department as a whole, more than 5,000. This would be the biggest police investigation in Cleveland history. The November elections returned Harold Burton as mayor, but Coroner Pierce was replaced by a young Democrat and a now legendary Samuel
L. Jackson.
Gerber. I'm sick of these heads.
On this motherfucking Ohio.
On Jackass Hill.
Found another fucking head on motherfucking Jackass Hill.
Gerber Fierce dedication to medicine, coupled with his law degree, put him at the forefront of the investigation.
Damn, Cleet, you went hard on this one.
February 1937,
A man
found the upper half of a woman's torso washed up on the shore east of Brattonnell. Unlike the previous victims, the cause of death had not been decapitation.
What?
This had happened after she was already dead. The lower half of the torso washed ashore 3 months later at about East 30th Street. The woman was in her mid-20s. She was never identified. June 1937, a teenage boy discovered a human skull under the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge. Next to it was a burlap bag containing the skeletal remains of what turned out to be a petite black woman, about 40 years old. Dental work allowed for the unofficial identification as Rose Wallace of Scoville Avenue. Police followed every lead they had on her. They led nowhere.
God, that's going to be so frustrating in this case. They just have nothing to go off of.
I know.
Just a bunch of heads, man.
July 1937. There were labor problems in the flats in the summer of 1937, and the National Guard had been called in to maintain order. A young guardsman standing watch by West 3rd Street Bridge saw the first piece of a victim, number 9, Bobby, in the Cuyahoga River in the wake of the passing tugboat. Over the next few days, police recovered the entire body except for the head. From the waters of the Cuyahoga River, the abdomen had been gutted and the heart ripped out, clearly indicating a new element of viciousness in the killer's approach. The victim was in his mid to late 30s. He was never identified. April 1938, a young laborer on his way to work in the flats saw what he at first thought was a dead fish along the banks of the Cuyahoga River. Closer inspection revealed it to be the lower half of a woman's leg, the first piece of victim number 10 to be recovered. A month later, police pulled two burlap bags out of the river containing both parts of the torso and most of the rest of both legs. For the first time, Coroner Gerber detected drugs in the system. Were the drugs used to immobilize the victim, or was she an addict? The answer might have come if they had found the arms, but they never did. She was never identified.
God, if only we had the arms, we could tell.
I'd take a right arm. I don't even care. August 16, 1938, three scrap collectors foraging in a dump site in East 9th and Lakeside found the torso of a woman wrapped in a man's double-breasted blue blazer and then wrapped again in an old quilt.
Say that five times fast. Double-breasted blue blazer.
I did it pretty good.
Double-breasted blue blazer.
I can speak tonight, apparently. I don't know.
It's the Baptist, man. It's flowing through you.
The legs and arms were discovered in a recently constructed makeshift box wrapped in brown butcher paper and held together with rubber bands. The head had been similarly wrapped. Gerber noted that some of these parts looked as if they had been refrigerated. While searching for more pieces, the police discovered the remains of a second body only yards away. These two bodies had been placed in a location that was in plain view from Elliot Ness's office window, almost as if taunting him. Neither victim 11 or 12 were ever identified. August 18, 1938, at 12:40 a.m., Elliot Ness and a group of 35 police officers and detectives raided the homeless encampments in Kingsbury Run. 11 squad cars, 2 police vans, and 3 fire trucks descend on the largest cluster of makeshift shacks where the Cuyahoga River twists behind Public Square. Ness raiders work their way south through the run, eventually gathering up 63 men. At dawn, police and firemen searched the deserted shanties for clues. Then, on orders from Safety Director Ness, the shacks were set on fire and burned to the ground.
Damn. Arson.
The press severely criticized Ness for his actions. The public remained afraid and frustrated. Critics said the raid would do nothing to solve the murders, and they were right. July 1939, County Sheriff Martin O'Dell arrested 52-year-old Bohemian bricklayer Frank Dolezal for the murder of Flo Polillo. Dolezal had lived with her while, and subsequent investigation revealed, he had been acquainted with Edward Andrazi and Rose Wallace. So he's tied to 3 of the victims, right? His confession turned out to be bewildering, blend of incoherent ramblings and neat, precise details, almost as if he had been coached.
That's weird.
Before he could go to trial, Dolezal was found dead in his cell.
Oh, God.
The 5'8" Dolezal had hanged himself from a hook only 5'7" off the floor. Gerber's autopsy revealed 6 broken ribs, all of which had been obtained while in sheriff's custody. Yeah. To this day, few believe that Frank Dolezal was a torso killer. The Kingsbury Run murders remain one of the most perplexing cases in our national criminal history. Rumors abound as to who may have been the killer. One thing is very clear. Elliot Ness had a suspect who he believed was undoubtedly the killer. All official police records of this case had been lost, destroyed, or removed. So we'll go ahead and stop there. There's Damn. Theories about who it is, but we just don't have time.
We have time.
No.
No.
Move on to the next one.
Go ahead.
Oh, really? All right. Yes, sir. That's crazy. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it was a fun one. I actually enjoyed it.
It was fun. Cleet enjoyed looking up that murder spree. All right. Well, let's go into Oklahoma for someone named Nanny Doss, also known as the Giggling Granny. The Giggling Granny. I saw the name of this and I was like, hell yes.
I'm going to take you to the giggle hunt.
This is going to be interesting. You're smoking something?
I'm going to take off my teeth. I'm going to get you my gums.
All right. So Nanny was an American serial killer responsible for the deaths of 11 people between the 1920s and 1954. But not just any people. All the victims were her family.
Sad.
Let's get into the crazy tale of this crazy woman, the Giggling Granny. Nanny was born on November 4th, 1905 in Blue Mountain, Alabama. Her mother was Louisa, or Lou, Holder, and her father was James F. Hazel. She was one of 5 children, having 1 brother, 3 other sisters. The family hated their father James, as he was described as controlling and abusive to them. James would force his children to work on the family farm and refuse to let them go to school, which resulted in Nanny having a poor academic performance.
You don't need a school when you can farm.
If you can milk a cow and you can collect some eggs, you don't need to know math.
You don't need the fancy math.
2 eggs plus 2 eggs equals 6 eggs. Our family's eating well. During a train ride to see relatives in southern Alabama when Nanny was 7, she hit her head on a metal bar on the seat in front of her when the train abruptly stopped. This impact led Nanny to experience several headaches, blackouts, and depression for years after. It was bad enough that she blamed these and her mental instability on that accident.
Mm.
When I was 7 years old, I was on a train and I hit my head and it caused me to kill a bunch of people. Fucking perplexing, if you ask me. I don't know. It's just when you blame an accident when you're 7 for murdering a bunch of people.
Man, that's kind of funny.
It's weird.
I hit my head,
right?
And I just had to kill people.
I don't know. I just wanted to kill.
I didn't know where I was headed after that.
Still with the head jokes, huh?
I know. People are going to get mad.
No, they're not. She loved to read her mother's romance magazines as a child. Ooh. And would daydream of her own romantic future. Her favorite part of the magazines were the Lonely Hearts column. Basically, was an ad of someone seeking a friend or romantic partner. So it's like today's Tinder, right? It was like the Lonely Hearts column. Nanny's dad prevented his daughters from wearing makeup or attractive clothing as he thought that this would help prevent them from being molested by men.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it's one of those guys. To take it a step further, he also forbade them from attending dances and other social events. Just your good old-fashioned overprotective father figure.
Mm.
You know, nothing's going to come of that. Nanny first became married at 16 years old to Charlie Braggs, who was her co-worker at the linen factory. With her dad's approval, they married only a short 4 months after they started dating. The fuck is this, Utah? Charlie was the only son to a single mother, who insisted that she continue living with him after he married Nanny. Nanny wrote this letter on the matter. Like, can you imagine, like, your wife's mom moving in, because it's like, only child, and she's like, I must live with you.
Like, get out now.
No, you wouldn't.
Get out.
Get out!
There's a garage.
Go live up.
That's what you get.
Go live by my wood stack.
Give me your social security.
So this is the letter she wrote. I married, as my father wished, in 1921 to a boy I only knowed about for 4 or 5 months, who had no family, only a mother who was unwed and who had taken over my life completely when we were married. She never seen anything wrong with what she done, but she would take spells. She would not let my mother stay all night. It's quite the letter, right?
Yeah. I mean,
she's uneducated, so... Mm. With Bragg's mother living with them, it's no shocker that she took a lot of his attention while limiting Nanny's activities. The marriage yielded 4 daughters between 1923 and 1927. The stress of the marriage drove Nanny to drink and pushing her then casual smoking habit to a heavy addiction. Both of them correctly suspected each other of infidelity, which was happening for sure. They're both just sleeping around.
Wait, what?
Yeah, and Braggs would often leave for days on end. So they would, like, they hated this marriage because, like, her dad's like, yeah, go ahead and get married after 4 months of dating. They're both sleeping around, and he would just leave for days on end to go sleep
with people. I'm going to go drink with the boys for a couple of nights.
Wink, wink. Why are you winking? Did you get chlamydia or did I?
Why does it hurt to pee?
In 1927, the couple's 2 middle girls passed away to suspected food poisoning. Shortly after they passed, Braggs took their eldest child, Melvina, and fled, leaving Florine, the newborn, behind. His mom died not long after that. Nanny then took a job in a cotton mill so she could support Florine on her own. So their 2 middle children died, guy left, and then his mom died, who I'm assuming, like, he just left with her. So... 3 people dead really quick. Suspicious.
A little sus.
So Braggs brought Melvina back during the summer of 1928, along with a divorcee and her own child. So he brings another woman home with her child. Oh, he's like, okay. Hey, I'm back
with this other lady. Here's my friend.
Yeah, it's my friend. We just like to play Uno together.
We're good friends. We're going to play Uno in the shower.
Shortly after this, Braggs and Nanny divorced, and Nanny took her 2 girls back to her mother's house. Braggs would constantly say that he had left her as he was frightened of her. He's like, I'm really scared of this lady. That's why I slept around. She frightened me. Nanny would marry again, this time to Robert Franklin Harrelson. They met and married in the year 1929 and lived in Jacksonville with Melvina and Florine. After only a few months, she discovered that he was an alcoholic with a criminal record for assault. Despite that, however, the marriage lasted a total of 16 years. Glad they were able to make that work out.
Yeah, the alcohol kind of helped.
Nanny's daughter, Melvina, gave birth to a baby boy named Robert Lee Haynes in 1943, with another baby following 2 years later, before tragically passing soon afterward. Melvina, who was exhausted from the labor and groggy from ether, claimed that she saw her visiting mother push a hat pin into the baby's head. It's kind of morbid, right?
What the fuck?
Yeah, so like she is claiming that I saw my mom push this hat pin into my newborn baby's head, which caused it to die. She asked for clarification from her husband and sister, where they claimed that Nanny said the baby was dead while she was holding a pin. I don't know, it just seems like a lot of craziness. The doctors, on the other hand, could not provide a positive explanation behind the death of the baby. The grieving parents drifted apart after the death, and Melvina began dating a soldier. Nanny disapproved of him, and during the time Melvina was visiting her dad after a horrible fight with Nanny, her son Robert died mysteriously under her care on July 7th, 1945.
Keeps killing people.
Yeah, so her grandchild died in her care. So that's, you know, fourth, fifth now.
What a rotten granny.
The death was ruled as asphyxia from unknown causes. Unknown causes. Mm. And 2 months later, Nanny collected the $500 life insurance that she had taken out on Robert. Suspicious? Suspicious? In 1945, Nanny's husband Harrelson raped her, and the next day she put rat poison in his corn whiskey jar, causing him to die that evening. It's a quick turn of events. Nanny met her third husband, Arlie Lanning, through another Lonely Hearts column during her travels in Lexington, North Carolina, marrying him only 3 days later. 3 days. She wastes absolutely no time getting hitched.
Get him.
Unfortunately, much like her prior husband Harrelson, Lanning was an alcoholic womanizer. In this marriage, however, it was Nanny who would often disappear, this time for months on end. So she's like, you know what? I'm going to go sleep around.
Oh, girls' night.
Goodbye.
Girls' week.
It's my friend's. Month. It's my friend's birthday. She played the part of doting housewife when she was home, and when he died of what they ruled as heart failure, the townsfolk all supported her at the funeral. A lot of people die around this lady. I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
Why does everyone keep dying around me?
Shortly after the funeral, the house that they had, which was left to Lanning's sister, burned to the ground, and the insurance money went to Nanny. She quickly banked the money, and after Lanning's mother passed away in her sleep, quote-unquote, she left North Carolina, ending up at her sister Dovey's house. Dovey was bedridden, and shortly after Nanny arrived, she passed away.
How tragic.
Nanny was desperate for another husband, so she joined a dating service called the Diamond Circle Club, meeting Richard L. Morton soon after. He was from Jamestown, North Carolina, and they married in 1952 in Emporia, Kansas. Now, this guy did not have a drinking problem, but he was adulterous. She wound up poisoning him, and he died on May 19th, 1953. Even more crazy, she poisoned her own mother, who was staying with them, in January 1953. Crazy, right? Nanny then married a man named Samuel Doss of Tulsa, Oklahoma, in June 1953. Doss had been a Nazarene minister who tragically lost his family to a tornado in Carroll County, Arkansas. Samuel rather disapproved of the romance novels and stories that Nanny was obsessed with. He's like, stop reading all of this.
Devil's book.
Devil's book.
The devil's boinker books.
I know you like to get off while reading those novels. I am a good man.
God killed your family in a tornado, bro.
Why did he take your family, Samuel? In September that same year, he was admitted to the hospital for flu-like symptoms, where they diagnosed him with a severe digestive tract infection. He had been treated and released on October 5th. He died on October 12th, 1954, 7 days after he was released. Weird. Nanny killed him that evening in a rush to collect both life insurance policies that she had taken out on him. The sudden death so soon after being released alerted his doctor, who ordered an autopsy. He's like, he was fine 7 days ago, and now he dies.
Yeah, it looks bad on the
doctor. Something's weird. So his doctor ordered an autopsy, which revealed a massive amount of arsenic in his system. The discovery led to Nanny's arrest. Nanny went on to confess to killing four of her husbands, her mother, her sister, grandson, and mother-in-law. The state of Oklahoma centered this case solely on Samuel Doss. Nanny was prosecuted by J. Howard Edmondson, who later became governor of Oklahoma. She pleaded guilty on May 17, 1955, and was sentenced to life imprisonment. They did not pursue the death penalty due to her sex. She was never charged with the other deaths. Nanny died from leukemia in the hospital ward of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in 1965 and is buried at Oak Hill Memorial Park in McAllister, Oklahoma. So that's the giggling granny. Murdered a bunch of people in her family.
What a rotten granny.
Okay, so now we're on to Oregon.
Yep, Oregon. We're going to be talking about Randall Woodfield, the I-5 killer. So born in Salem, Oregon, in December 1950, Randy Woodfield. Was the classic all-American boy next door. He made good grades, and high school coaches recognized his natural athletic talents, making him the star of Newport's football team. Newport's. You like Newport?
No, I don't smoke.
I like Newport's. They were good. When Woodfield started to expose himself in public, everybody laughed it off at first.
What?
And members of the coaching staff suppressed his first arrest to keep him eligible for the squad. I don't know why I didn't go into this, but he just exposed himself and shown his wee-wee. All right.
You like my dick? Helicopter time.
Look at my dick. In August 1970, attending college in Ontario, Oregon, he was picked up again, this time for vandalizing an ex-girlfriend's apartment. 2 years later, in Vancouver, Washington, he logged his first adult arrest on charges of indecent exposure, receiving a suspended sentence. A similar arrest in Portland earned him more suspended time in June of 1973. Woodfield got a break that year when he was drafted by the Green Bay Packers.
What?
But he could not shake his problems with a trip across the country. In 1974, after a dozen flashing
incidents, dude, keep your dick away,
called unwelcome attention to Randy, the Packers gave up and sent him home.
Can you imagine in the middle of a game, he's like pulling his pants down, I'm going to get you.
I'm streaking. He was the first streaker in the NFL.
No, he was the first streaker player in the NFL.
Oh, okay. All right. The local boy made good, was coming home in failure, a disgrace.
What is wrong with this person?
In early 1975, several Portland women were accosted by a knife-wielding young man forced to perform oral sex before they were robbed of their handbags. Police women were staked out as decoys, and Woodfield was arrested on March 3rd after stealing marked money from one of the officers.
That'd be such a crazy job, pretending to be a street worker. All right. As a policeman. Reminds me of Dexter. You ever watch Dexter?
Yeah.
The ending sucks, I know.
No, like, after season 3, it just got stupid.
Season 4 was the best.
In April, he pled guilty to reduced charges of second-degree robbery, receiving a sentence of 10 years in prison. 4 years later, in July 1973, Woodfield was freed on parole. On October 9th, 1980, a former classmate of Randy's, Sherry Ayers, was raped and murdered in Portland, bludgeoned to the head and stabbed repeatedly in the neck. Woodfield was routinely questioned and refused to sit for polygraph examinations. Homicide detectives found his answers generally evasive and deceptive, but his blood type did not match the semen found inside the victim's body, and he was not charged. A short month later, still in Portland, Darcy Fix and Doug Altick were shot to death, execution style, in Altick's apartment. A .32 caliber revolver was missing from the scene, and while the female victim had been formally involved with one of Woodfield's closest friends, police had nothing to suggest that Randy was the killer. On December 9th, 1980, a young bandit wearing a fake beard held up a gas station in Vancouver, Washington. 4 nights later, in Eugene, Oregon, the same man raided an ice cream parlor, rebounding on December 14th with the robbery of a drive-in restaurant at Albany. A week later, in Seattle, the gunman added a new twist, trapping a waitress in the restroom of a chicken restaurant and forcing her to masturbate him. 20 minutes later, smiling through his phony beard, he robbed another ice cream parlor and escaped with cash in hand. What the hell, man? Why does he rob ice cream parlors? January was another busy month for the gunman. Police were already calling the I-5 bandit after his apparent highway of preference. On the 8th, he raided the same Vancouver gas station a second time, forcing a female attendant to expose her breasts after looting the till. 3 days later, he robbed a market in Eugene, surfacing at Sutherland, Oregon, on January 12th, to wound a female grocery clerk with gunfire. He was wearing a fake beard in Corvallis on January 14th when he invaded a home occupied by two sisters, aged 8 and 10. The girls were forced to disrobe before fellatiating their assailant. In Salem, 4 days later, the target was an office building where he killed Sari Hull and wounded Beth Wilmot after sexually abusing both women. The bandit rounded off the month on January 26th and 29th with robberies in Eugene, Medford, and Grant Pass, fondling a clerk and a female customer in the latter case. So he's just going on a rampage, you know, down I-5, doing bad things to women and robbing places. On February 3rd, 1981, Donna Eckard, 37, and her 14-year-old daughter were found dead in their home at Mountain Gate, California, north of Redding. Together in bed, each had been shot several times in the head, with lab tests revealing the girl had been sodomized. The same day, a female clerk was kidnapped, raped, and sodomized after a holdup in Redding. An identical crime was reported from Eureka on February 4th, and the bandit robbed an Ashland motel that same night. 5 days later, in Corvallis, he held up a fabric store, molesting the clerk and her customer before departing. February 12th witnessed a triple header with robberies in Vancouver, Olympia, and Bellevue, Washington. The last two stops included three more sexual assaults. On February 15th, Julie Reitz, a former girlfriend of Woodfield, was shot and killed at her home in Beaverton, Oregon. The investigation had focused on Randy by February 28th, and by that time, the I-5 gunman had struck three more times in Eugene on February 18th and the 21st, with a final sex assault at Corvallis on February 25th. Interrogation of Woodfield on March 3rd, 1981, led to a search of his apartment 2 days later. On March 7th, he was taken into custody after several victims picked him from a police lineup. By March 16th, indictments were rolling in from various jurisdictions in Washington and Oregon, including multiple counts of murder, rape, and sodomy, attempted kidnapping, armed robbery, and possession of firearms.
Firearms?
And possession of firearms by an ex-convict.
I found a bunch of firearms.
Can you imagine just being like picked out just by several people? It's like, you gotta know it's him.
Yeah.
Like, several of the victims, like, yeah, that's the guy.
That's him.
Anyways.
No question.
The courts in Salem got to Woodfield first on charges of murder, attempted murder, and two counts of sodomy. Convicted on all counts on June 26, 1981. The All-American Killer was sentenced to a prison term of life plus 90 years. By December, conviction of sodomy and weapons charges in Benton County, Oregon, had added 35 more years to Randy's time. So he ended up going to jail. Good riddance. What a
life
creepy dude.
And 90.
Yeah.
It's a good way of saying you are never getting out.
Yeah.
All right. On to Pennsylvania for a guy named Gary Michael Heidnick. This guy is, and they're all shitty. This guy is horrible. Gary Michael Heidnick was an American murderer and serial rapist who kidnapped, tortured, and raped six women, killing two of them and holding them captive in a self-dug pit in his basement in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
What?
He was one of the inspirations for the Buffalo Bill character in The Silence of the Lambs.
Puts the lotion on the skin or
it gets the hose again. Yep. Let's get into this twisted psycho. Gary Heidnick was born on November 22, 1943, in Eastlake, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. His parents were Michael and Ellen Heidnick. Gary had one younger brother named Terry. Heidnick's parents divorced in 1946, and their mother cared for both boys for roughly 4 years before being sent to live with their dad and his new wife. Gary claimed that he was emotionally abused by his dad. He had a lifelong bedwetting issue and claimed that his dad would force him to hang his dirty sheets in his windows in full view of the neighbors as a form of humiliation. It's like, I want everyone in the neighborhood to know you pissed the sheets.
You pissed me off. Now we're going to show your piss off.
His dad denied these allegations at all. Gary kept to himself at school and didn't interact with fellow students, refusing also to make eye contact. One day, a new female student trying to be nice asked, "Did you get your homework done, Gary?" He shouted at her, saying that she wasn't worthy enough to talk to him. "Don't talk to me, swine!
Don't you know who I am?
I am Gary Heidnick." He was constantly teased about his oddly shaped head, which he and his brother claimed was a result of him falling out of a tree.
It's like a Dark Arnold story.
Right? Heidnick performed well in school, testing with an IQ of 148, and with the encouragement of his dad, he enrolled at the Staunton Military Academy when he was 14 years old, for 2 years, leaving before graduation. He spent another period in public high school before dropping out to join the United States Army when he was only 17. He served in the Army for 13 months. During basic training, his drill sergeant graded him as excellent. He was denied after applying for several specialist positions, including military police, and eventually was sent to San Antonio, Texas, where he was trained as a medic, excelling through medical training. He wasn't in Texas long before being transferred to the 46th Army Surgical Hospital in Landstuhl, West Germany. He earned his GED only a few short weeks of being there. In August 1962, Heidnick started complaining of severe headaches, dizziness, blurred vision, and nausea. Neurologists diagnosed him with gastroenteritis, also noting that he displayed symptoms of mental illness, prescribing him trifluoperazine. He was transferred to a military hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in October 1962, being diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder and getting an honorable discharge from military service. So, I mean, at least he's not one of the killers who was dishonorably discharged, right?
Yeah, that definitely helps character, Brayden.
It definitely helps. He's one of those.
Great job.
He's one of those serial killers who wasn't dishonorably discharged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That puts him in a totally different category.
Different category of horrible killer.
Yeah.
Not long after his discharge, Heidnick started as a licensed practical nurse, enrolling at the University of Pennsylvania, but dropping out after only one semester. He worked at a Veterans Administration hospital in Coatesville, but was fired for poor attendance and rude behaviors towards the patients. He spent a lot of time in and out of psychiatric hospitals between 1962 and his arrest, attempting to unalive himself at least 13 times. His mother did unalive herself in 1970, being diagnosed with bone cancer and being an alcoholic. She drank mercuric chloride.
Damn,
that
dude,
sounds like just a horrible way to go. His brother Terry would also spend a chunk of time in mental institutions, also attempting to unalive himself several times. In October 1971, Heidnik incorporated a church called the United Church of the Ministers of God, starting out with a measly 5 followers, but would eventually amass over $500,000, which is roughly $2.7 million by today's standards. In 1975, the account was opened under the church's name with Merrill Lynch, the initial deposit being $1,500. We opened up a church and made a bunch of fucking money.
What we should do. Let's go to Colt.
This is called the Church of the Abyss.
No, it's Worship Cthulhu, man.
I'm down. Heidnik used a matrimonial service to meet his wife, Betty Disto, and they corresponded via mail for 2 years before he eventually proposed. Disto arrived from the Philippines in September 1985, and they married in Maryland the following month on the 3rd of October. The marriage ended rather quickly when she found him in bed with several other women at the same time.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Nice. Yeah, that's going to end your marriage. The marriage was doomed from the start because he supposedly used her as a lookout while he had sex with other women.
What?
Yeah, he's like, I want you to kind of watch and make sure that I can sleep with this other woman. It was weird, man. I don't know.
Make sure her husband doesn't come in. You're the lookout.
She accused him of raping and abusing her several times as well throughout the marriage. She was able to leave him in January of 1986, and unbeknownst to Heidnik, he had gotten her pregnant, leading her to request child support payments from him in 1987. Her son was born on September 15th, 1986, and she named him Jesse John Disto. Heidnik would have another child with another woman named Gail Linkow, a son they named Gary Jr., who was sadly put in foster care soon after his birth. Heidnik had a third child as well, with another woman named Anjanette Davidson, who was illiterate and mentally disabled. Their daughter, Maxine Davidson, was born on March 16, 1978, also immediately being placed in foster care. Not long after the birth of Maxine, Heidnik was arrested for kidnapping and raping Anjanette's sister, Alberta, who was living in an institution for the mentally disabled in Penn Township. He signed her out of the institution, took her home, and locked her in a storage room in his basement. She was found and returned later, where it was discovered she was raped and sodomized and had also contracted gonorrhea.
God, that's dark.
Yeah, this guy, not good. Heidnik was charged with kidnapping, rape, unlawful restraint, false imprisonment, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and interfering with the custody of a committed person. In 1976, Heidnik was charged with aggravated assault and carrying an unlicensed pistol after he shot the tenant of a house that he offered for rent. The bullet grazed the man's face.
Jesus.
He was arrested again in 1986 after he raped his wife, being charged with assault, indecent assault, spousal rape, and involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. All right, so we're going to get into his string of serial rapes and murders. So obviously it's not been good, but trigger warning here. On November 25th, 1986, Heidnik abducted 25-year-old Josefina Rivera. By January 1987, he kidnapped 4 other women, all of which he held captive in a pit in the basement of his house at 3520 North Marshall Street in North Philadelphia. The captives were raped, beaten, and tortured. 24-year-old Sandra Lindsay, one of the women he captured, died from a combination of starvation, torture, and an untreated fever. Heidnik dismembered her body, but had some problems with the arms and the legs. He put them in a freezer and labeled them dog food. He proceeded to cook her ribs in the oven and boiled her head in a pot on the stove.
The fuck?
Yeah. The smell of the boiled head was so bad that neighbors called the police to complain of the nauseating smell that was coming from his home.
I hate these episodes sometimes.
Police arrived and then left after Heidnik told them, I'm cooking a roast. I fell asleep and it burnt. So they just like, okay, well, don't fall asleep while you're cooking. There are a few sources out there that suggest Heidnik ground up Lindsay's flesh and mixed it with dog food to feed his other victims. Chuck Peruto, his defense attorney, said that there was no evidence of this after they examined the cuisine art and other tools in his kitchen.
Sure, the dogs are well fed. However, we don't know what he did with the minced human meat.
Yeah. Peruto said that Heidnik simply made up the story, supporting the insanity defense, and that he started the rumor of cannibalism in public. There was no evidence supporting anyone eating human flesh. One of the methods of torture Heidnik used was electric shock, and at one point, he forced three of his captives into a pit bound in chains. He then demanded Rivera and another captive to fill the pit with water, forcing Rivera also to help him apply the electric current using a stripped extension cord attached to the chains. Deborah Dudley, who was 23, was electrocuted to death. Heidnik disposed of her body in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. It was on January 18, 1987, that Heidnik abducted his youngest victim, Jacqueline Askins, who was only 18 years old. During an interview on a special report called Gary Heidnik's House of Horrors, which aired on May 5, 2018, Askins said that Heidnik wrapped duct tape around the mouths of the victims and stabbed them in the ears with a screwdriver. Ah, it just sounds fucking awful. On March 23, 1987, 24-year-old Agnes Adams was abducted by Heidnik with the help of Rivera. The day after, Rivera convinced Heidnik to let her go temporarily, allowing her to visit her family. He drove her to a gas station, telling her that he would wait for her there. From there, she walked to her boyfriend's home. The thought of confronting Heidnik had crossed her mind, but instead she chose to call the police, probably the smartest option. The officers who responded to the call had noticed the chafing from the chains on her legs. They went to the gas station where Heidnik was waiting and detained him. Cyril Brown, his purported best friend, was also arrested and was later released on a $50,000 bail and an agreement that he would testify against Heidnik. Brown admitted, in part, that he had witnessed Lindsay's death in the basement torture chamber, also witnessing the dismemberment of her body. Not long after Heidnik's arrest in April 1987, he attempted to hang himself in his jail cell. During his arraignment, Heidnik made the ridiculous claim that the women were already in the house when he moved in.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
He's like, I moved in and there was just all these women in the basement.
There are all these women in the basement.
What do you want me to do?
I fed them and clothed them.
What do you want me to do? There's just a bunch of women in my house. They were already there. His defense attorney, Charles Peruto Jr., attempted to prove that Heidnik was legally insane. The insanity claim, however, was successfully rebutted by the prosecution, which was led by Charles Gallagher III. Given the fact that he made approximately $550,000 via his brokerage account, proved that he was an astute investor, which rendered him not insane. On July 1st, 1988, Heidnik was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 6 counts of kidnapping, 5 counts of rape, 4 counts of aggravated assault, and 2 counts of involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. He was sentenced to death and incarcerated at the State Correctional Institution in Pittsburgh. In January 1989, he attempted to unalive himself again by overdosing on his prescribed Thorazine. In 1997, Heidnik's daughter Maxine and his ex-wife Betty Disto filed a suit in federal court in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where they requested a stay of execution on the basis that Heidnik was not competent enough to be executed. After 2 years of legal proceedings in various courts, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania issued its final warning on July 3, 1999 that cleared the way for his execution. Heidnik's last meal was 2 slices of cheese pizza and black coffee. He was executed by lethal injection on July 6, 1999, and his body was cremated. He was the last person executed by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and is the 3rd of 3 people executed there since the resumption of the death penalty.
See ya, wouldn't want to be ya. Yeah.
So that's the disgusting fuck called Heidnik. So then we're going to end on Rhode Island.
All right, let's talk about Craig Price, Rhode Island, the Warwick Slasher.
West Valley Wanker? Whacker?
I heard you're wanking.
No, not that kind.
God, prison was bad. All right, they call him Iron Man, a hulking teenage football player with a baby face and a winsome smile who lived with his parents in a small ranch house in the Buttonwoods section of town. Then one summer night in 1987, Craig Price crept across his neighbor's yard, broke into a little brown house on Inez Avenue, and stabbed Rebecca Spencer 58 times.
Fucking 58 times?
She was a 27-year-old mother of 2. He was 13.
So obviously there's passion behind it, because you don't stab someone 58 times because you're bored.
He was 13, man.
You can't have a passionate murdering when you're 13?
2 years passed before Price struck again. Joan Heaton, 39 was butchered with the kitchen knives she had bought earlier that day. The bodies of her daughters, Jennifer 10 and Melissa 8, were found in pools of blood, pieces of knives broken off in their bones. Jennifer had been stabbed 62 times. Buttonwoods was paralyzed. Police combed the streets. Neighbors padlocked their doors. The Heaton house was just a few hundred yards from the Spencer home, and the question hung thick over the tidy working-class neighborhood. What kind of monster was living in their midst? The answer came 2 weeks later. Price was a wisecracking 15-year-old who had been in minor trouble for petty burglaries, thieving, he called it, but who seemed friendly to neighbors and was always surrounded by friends. Police had become suspicious after Price lied about a deep gash on his finger. They knew from the crime scene that the killer had cut himself. A bloody sock print matched Price's size 13 feet. They found the knives in his backyard shed. At the police station, his mother sobbing softly beside him, Price calmly confessed to the four murders. Yet even as police and prosecutors celebrated the capture of Rhode Island's most notorious serial killer, they were reminded of a grim reality. In 5 years, Price would be free to kill again. Price was a month shy of his 16th birthday. As a juvenile, he would be released from the Youth Correctional Center when he was 21, the maximum penalty under Rhode Island law at the time. His records would be sealed. The 5'10", 240-pound killer would be free to resume his life as if the murders had never occurred. The law was on the side of Price, and he knew it. "When I get out, I'm going to smoke a bomber." I don't fucking know what that means. Price yelled to the crowd as he was led, handcuffed from the courthouse. Jeffrey Pine, the assistant attorney general, said that he had never felt such frustration or disgust. "There is something fundamentally wrong with a system that allowed someone who killed four people to simply be free at 21, Pine said. And so Pine and others embarked on a remarkable mission. They would change the system so that future young murderers could be locked up for life. At the same time, they would do their best to ensure that Price himself would stay behind bars long past his 21st birthday. It is an extraordinary response to an extraordinary case and involved every level of government, from the governor's and attorney general offices to state legislator, the police, and the courts." So they ended up, like, giving him a life sentence. And this guy is like, he's like, "I've already paid my price to society." Like, he said that right now because he's still alive. I'm like, bro, rot in fucking jail.
Seriously.
Anyways, that sums it up.
Damn. Crazy. All right, that's part 8 of our serial killers. Only 2 more episodes to go, and we're done. So we're eagerly looking for the next series. So if you have a suggestion on an iceberg or a series you want us to cover, enter the abysspod at gmail.com is the best place to get a hold of us. And we're going to wrap it up tonight with a huge thank you to our paid supporters of the show. As always, Modelo Time, Fleet Meat, Claytor, Lord of Soup, Curtis and Lara, Mothman, Devin C., Lara, Conklin Family, and Lou. Thank you very much for your constant support of the show. It's very, very much appreciated. And again, we are at 488 subscribers on YouTube, so we're 12 away from our journey to the Clown Motel. So if you want to see us go, like, comment, subscribe. It really helps us.
I might be biased, but I think cleat meat tastes good. Anyways, if you're listening to us on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe, as it really helps us get us out there. As always, thank you for entering the abyss.
Until next time.